Thank you all for coming out. I was listening to a radio show on NPR called, what is it called? 1A, I think it's called. It's a great show. And there were some guests, this was about a month ago, that the commentator had. They were some young climate change activists. The famous Greta Thunberg, who didn't want to be famous, but she is. There was a fellow called Carl Smith, 17-year-old activist from Alaska, Anissa Khan, a 23-year-old activist, and the executive director of Sustain Us, a nonprofit youth-led advocacy group that goes to the UN and meets with people and advocates for life-affirming practice on our planet, and a 16-year-old woman named Madeline Graham, who is one of the people who organizes Fridays for Future. They're the group that skip school on Fridays and go and walk in the streets. So I came in kind of at the middle of this interview that was being done with these young people, and there was one of the quotes that just completely blew me away. And when I heard it, maybe you've heard it, it was something that Greta Thunberg said in her talk that she gave to the UN Climate Action Summit. But when I heard this statement that she said, I thought, this is one of the most incredible examples I have ever heard of what I would call passionate non-duality. You know, we talk and we teach about non-duality in Buddhism, that it appears that the world functions in opposites that are often in opposition, but that in truth, everything is interconnected and everything is one, and there are no objects. And yet, we practice with this dilemma that, of course, we also are objects, you know, and this is an ongoing puzzle and koan that runs throughout Zen literature and Buddhist teachings and in our own lives as we grapple with how to be seemingly two things, you know, how to be both a particular being with a particular set of needs, but also to be one who is part of the whole. And so when I heard this statement, it's a statement of non-duality, but it is not neutral. And I think sometimes when we hear about non-duality, we imagine, oh, it's about being neutral. Now, there's nothing wrong with neutrality, but it's not necessarily neutral. It's just non-dual. So I want to read this quote, and then I want to speak more about how I see this as an expression of what I would call, this is my term, passionate non-duality. Because by passionate, I mean there's a person there. There's emotion there. This is not like, oh, yeah, whatever. This is somebody who deeply cares and yet is able to see this most challenging situation from a non-dual perspective. So this is the comment that Greta Thunberg made in her talk to the United Nations Climate Action Summit. I don't know what you were doing when you were her age, but I sure wasn't doing things like that. But, you know, what can we say? And this is what she said. She said, in the middle of her talk, she said, for more than 30 years, the science has been crystal clear. How dare you look away, saying you're doing enough when the politics and solutions needed are still nowhere in sight. You say you hear us and understand the urgency, but no matter how sad and angry I am, I do not want to believe that, because if you really understood the situation and still kept on failing to act, then you would be evil, and that I refuse to believe. So here she is saying she is sad and she is angry. And she very specifically speaks about ways that she is sad and angry. And of all people, you know, the younger you are, the more right you have to be sad and angry for what you're going to have to deal with. That our generation, not everybody in this room, but those of us who are of a certain age, you know, we're not going to be around necessarily too much longer. And many of you and our children, your children, will be the ones who will be cleaning up the mess, if there is even a mess to clean up. So here she's saying that no matter how sad and angry she is, she refuses to believe that the inaction of the adults is because of evil. And this was echoed by the young woman Madeline when the commentator said, you know, how do you keep your hope for the future? And she referred back to what Greta had said and says, because, as Greta said in her speech, I do not believe that world leaders are evil. I refuse to believe that they are evil. So this is very challenging, because don't we want to think that they're evil? Don't we want to think that the people who don't do things the way we think are the right way? And how can you argue with that? You know, how could you argue with those of us who feel, oh, if you know about all these things and you're still, as she said, where's another one of her? She's such a potent speaker. You know, all you can do is talk about money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you, right? So there's every reason to want to get on the train of they're evil, and they're doing it because they're evil. And here is the very person who is probably, you know, most stands to suffer more than any of us in this room in the future. And she's saying, I refuse to believe that it's happening because you're evil. Now, you could say, oh, my God, what a fool. How misguided. You know, how could she possibly think that way? But to me, this is the very, very, very challenge and the very opportunity that we are offered. And what does this sound like to you when you think about if you have this situation that seems impossible and nonetheless you vow to be upright? What does that sound like? Where have we heard that before? This is impossible, and yet I vow to do it anyhow. Where have we heard that before? The Bodhisattva vows, right. At the very crux of the Bodhisattva vow is the willingness to engage with the tension of this paradox, that our convenient way that we fit everything into good and evil in so much of our social constructs and our religious constructs, that's the easy way out. It's much easier that way. This is a much harder path, to walk this path of, I'm sad, I'm angry, I'm going to devote my life to do everything that I can to try to educate you and change your mind and inform your policy. And as I'm doing this, I refuse to believe that you're doing this because you're evil. It's like you just haven't woke up yet. Or something. I don't know what profound courage that it takes to take that stand. And I think that also in this articulation and in this activism that I'm going to speak a little bit more about, it's a modeling of another way that we get caught by this seeming either-or dilemma. We think that the presence of this cancels this out because they seem like opposites. And the teaching of non-duality is that is not accurate. They're both true. They do not cancel each other out. So easy to look at the horrific situation of species extinction and, you know, the flooding and the fires and all these like really horrific things that are happening on the planet. So easy to just get frozen, right? Oh my God. There's nothing that can be done. It's completely hopeless. There's no point in taking any action. What are you going to do then? Instead, just watch TV, or when you don't watch TV anymore, what do we watch? The screen, drink, you know, go to sleep. I don't know what, I mean, we all do these things, you know, but what again, what courage in the face of this to say, okay, put on my shoes, then drink my coffee in the morning, go out in the day, do what needs to be done. Do what needs to be done. What needs to be done? That's the Bodhisattva. Yeah, I know it's impossible. Okay, well, so what? What needs to be done? Because maybe it's ultimately impossible, but again, here's the absolute and the relative. In any one moment, you might completely save a life. You might completely end delusion. You know, those are the vows that we're going to chant together at the end. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Well, you're not going to save all the beings, but you might save a few. Maybe starting with yourself. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Well, you're not going to end them all, but you might end a few. So as I was listening to these young people, and the others have some very potent words too, which I'm going to share from this seat, I just kept having this feeling of this is bodhisattva practice. And you do not have to be a Buddhist to do it. But the beautiful thing, and one of the things I love about Buddhism, is that we do have these figures, these archetypes that have been articulated in the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, where we have, that we personify these qualities, and we call it them bodhisattvas. You know, there's kind of small b bodhisattva, which is, and just in case anybody doesn't know that term, I'm sort of talking here as if I presume everybody did, but it means a bodhi is awakening and sattva is being. So a being whose job it is to be participating in awakening. The bodhisattva isn't concerned with his or her own awakening. The bodhisattva practices to awaken with others, practices in service of others. The focus is not on this one and me. The focus is on you. What's needed here? Who are you? What do you need? What is the situation calling for? That's the bodhisattva's domain. And the bodhisattva is motivated by aspiration, not by circumstances. So bodhisattva practice, you're not like, well, I'll go and do this thing if there's enough, you know, people who are going to do it with me, or if the statistics are on my side. The bodhisattva is motivated by the aspiration, the vow to save or to awaken with others, the vow to watch the tendencies of our mind to have delusion and to end that, the vow to enter every activity and be with everything that's happening as a Dharma gate, the vow to be as much like Buddha as we can. That's aspirational living rather than, you know, calibrating off of what seems possible or what our statistics are, our chances of success. If you're going to look for the chances of success, you might as well quit now. There's no guarantee. And yet sometimes there are successes, amazing successes. So there are many different bodhisattvas, and what I did was I would like to bring forth four of my favorites, four of the ones that probably to many of you their names will be familiar, because what they do is they each exemplify a different aspect of the human experience, a different aspect of being one who is focusing on serving others and focusing on awakening with others. And it's really great that there's these different aspects, because it's not just one way. And at different times, different qualities are called for. So what I did, I took the liberty of looking at the words. I went and I downloaded the podcast from the interview that I found so meaningful, and I transcribed it. So I have it as text, and I consider it a case. I call this the case of the young activists speaking up about climate change. That's this case. And my commentary on this case is to point out the various bodhisattva characteristics that are spoken by these people in this case. I also can't help but bring in beloved elder Joanna Macy, because she's been doing this work for 40, 50 years and is one of my biggest inspirations in terms of the do-it-anyway modality. So the first bodhisattva Well, I'll name the four, just so that it's not overly mysterious. The ones that we usually hear about, well, they're right on the altar. Manjushri is, you know, one of the bodhisattvas, wisdom. On our altar, bodhisattva Manjushri is riding a lion. Sometimes you'll see Manjushri with a sword, because it's about discriminating, the power of discriminating mind, of being able to distinguish between this and that, and do the right thing. And then Avalokiteshvara, who's on the back of the altar, who's also known as Kuan Yin, or Kanon, Tara, is the bodhisattva of compassion, the one who hears the cries of the world. I'll talk about that. Samantabhadra, the shining practice bodhisattva. If you just did Sashin, you're going, oh, they're in the meal chant. Right, they're in the meal chant. They're all over. And then one who isn't so much talked about, but is the one I'm going to start with, the Sanskrit name being Shitigarbha, and known in Japanese as Jiso. And this is the bodhisattva who is willing to walk straight into hell to save beings. The old stories say that Shitigarbha told Buddha, you know, I vow I will go all the way into hell to save beings, to awaken with beings. I'm willing to completely face suffering and not be afraid of the suffering of the world and the suffering of others. I'm fearless. I will go there. Also is known as a protector of pilgrims. And then in Japan is known as Jiso, and is further known as a benefactor and protector of children. So there's a lot of interesting stories about this particular bodhisattva, but the quality that I saw in the speaking of these young people here is their willingness to really face the pain and face the facts of what's happening on our planet. And to speak that publicly, and to speak, as they say, truth to power. So Greta's words, and again, here she is standing in front of this, you know, world body, and she is saying, you know, people are suffering, people are dying, our ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of economic growth. How dare you? So here she is naming the specific pain. We so don't want to hear this, most of us. We don't want to hear about collapsing ecosystems. We don't want to think about extinction. We don't want to talk about and think about, you know, these kinds of things. It's too painful. So to me, Shitigarbha, Bodhisattva, Buddha, I am willing to walk all the way into hell. I am willing to face the fires. I am willing to name the suffering in order to support the awakening of other beings. Here's another example. This was Anisa Khan, the 23-year-old executive director of Sustain Us. She grew up in Oman, which is the heart of the fossil fuel industry. So she saw up close the impact of the fossil fuel industry on her culture and her people. And she also lives in a part of the world which is really feeling the impacts of climate change right now. Her family from the southeast coast of India, at the time of this, were in their sixth month of their city not having water. They were in the sixth month of their city not having water. And prediction is that 40% of India will have no access to water by 2040. That's 20 years from now. So the interviewer asked, what motivated you to get into this business? And she said, this is from Anisa. She says that her formative moment was when she was 18, and she was attending the UN Climate Conference as a student of college at the Atlantic. And she said, I saw so much injustice. The people feeling the impact are the most innocent in causation. Women, people of color, indigenous, low-income, young, the developing world. I was sitting in the room during the negotiation of the Paris Agreement. It was night. People were fighting over nitty-gritty wordings in the text. And at the same time, at my home, there was a massive storm going on. I felt so scared, so angry, and so hurt. I feel like I cannot wait for governments and industries to create the political will to work on this. So there is a quality that these young folks have, and I see this as the bodhisattva ability to face the facts and to feel the suffering and to go where the suffering is and not let that stop you, but actually let that inspire you into doing what you can. I also thought it was interesting that Jiso Bodhisattva is a protector of children, and they are just past children, young adults. And it also literally, Shiti means earth and Garba means womb. So another translation of this Bodhisattva is the earth womb Bodhisattva. And I believe you did a day sit not long ago, practicing with this particular Bodhisattva. So what that made me feel is, and this is, you know, as difficult as it is to think about this and to talk about it, the deep support of the earth, I just felt like there's something about this Bodhisattva, this earth womb Bodhisattva, that is also here to support us. You know, the great earth wants to live through us. Life wants to live. So this intimate relationship that we have with the earth, with all beings, is something that we have on our side as we walk this path. And interestingly, Jiso is also the protector of pilgrims. And this is a journey. So this is a very potent Bodhisattva for us to call on, embody, appreciate, admire, however it is that you practice, or if you do, you don't have to. But I invite that this can be a very encouraging kind of practice. Now, on one level, we're just making it all up. It's not like they really exist, right? But on the other hand, does anything really exist? And what are the stories, what are the images that we can bring forth that give us hope? That's where I see these bodhisattvas dwelling. So then there's Manjushri. Manjushri is the bodhisattva of wisdom, often associated with the positive discriminating factors of the mind. Manjushri is the one who invites us to dispel delusion by really looking at our mind and really looking at how we think and taking that up as a serious practice, not being laissez-faire, lackadaisical, about the impact that our choices that we make about what to do with what goes on up here, the choices that this has on our lives. Because we think we know, but we don't really know. And the ability to, on the one hand, the ability to know, to study, to know the difference between this and that, but on the other hand, also the ability to recognize how we don't know necessarily whether what we're thinking is delusion or not, right? We have to check it out. And I had a wonderful example of this with a person I was speaking with who gave me permission to use this story. And I've actually used it a couple times because I think it's a great one. We were talking about something and this person said, well, I know why that happened, and it happened because blah, 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 blah. This person had their reasons and their story about why it happened. And it was so interesting because I actually knew about the situation. And I said, this is so cool. You're 50% right and 50% wrong. And one of the aspects of the explanation for the situation was absolutely accurate. Yes, that is why that happened. The other was completely inaccurate. And I knew that because I had been there, and that wasn't why it happened. And I explained to them the situation. But this is so powerful because I bet for most of us, you're 50% right and you're 50% wrong. And Manjushri is the one who takes up dealing with that. Okay, I'm going to deal with that. And I'm going to try to investigate more thoroughly and more closely. Is this accurate or not? Is this the 50% that's right or the 50% that's wrong? Right? So one of the expressions of this very sharp kind of mind of Manjushri, I hear in, again, this is Greta, her fearless use of facts. And it blew me away. I mean, I had to keep going back and back and back on the transcription tape because her language is so complex. And this is her second language, as Jean pointed out to me when we were driving here today. So she says, the popular idea of, and I'm not reading this to you to lecture you about climate science. I'm reading this to you to demonstrate Manjushri Bodhisattva making distinctions, using the mind to speak truth to power. The popular idea of cutting our emissions in half in 10 years only gives us a 50% chance of staying below 1.5 degrees and the risk of setting off irreversible chain reactions beyond human control. 50% may be acceptable to you, but those numbers do not include tipping points, most feedback loops, additional warming hidden by toxic air pollution, or the aspects of equity and climate justice. They also rely on my generation sucking hundreds of billions of tons of your CO2 out of the air with technology that barely exists. So a 50% risk is not enough for those of us who have to live with the consequences. This is the power of the mind when we're unafraid of its ability to be sharp, to be definitive, to be accurate. And this is sorely missing in this conversation. We're afraid of the facts. Then there's Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, the one whose name means the one who hears the cries of the world. So we often attribute compassion to Bodhisattva, Avalokiteshvara. And I believe that this statement of I refuse to believe that you are evil is a statement of Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. Because Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when you truly feel the suffering of an other, they're no longer an object that you can make evil because you begin the lines between you and the other begin to dissolve when you start to feel the pain of the other as your own. You realize this is suffering. It's not that, you know, you woke up in the morning and you put on your evil hat and decided, how are all the ways that I can go around and, you know, do horrible things to other people? This is suffering. The manifestation of what is happening is suffering, and Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara feels that as her own, as his own. And this ability to feel the pain of the world and to respond with compassion is so, so, so important. This is one of the things that Joanna Macy spoke a lot about. I have a few pieces from her early work that I think is just so, so profound that I wanted to bring it forward because I think it's something that is really an important thing that we need to do in this time. You know, again, like Shikigarbha, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva is not afraid to feel the pain of the world. And that there is a cost that we have. I think part of why this whole climate situation is happening is because people won't let themselves feel the pain of it. Because if they did, as Greta said, they would have to do something. Do you know what apathy means? Apatheia. The inability to feel pain. This I got from Joanna Macy. So when we think about, you know, if it is the inability or refusal to experience pain. We become apathetic. So in a way, if we want to think about action or moving out of apathy, the gateway is actually to, as best we can, to be able to start allowing ourselves to feel the pain of the world and not be frozen and stopped by it, but to be opened and empowered by actually feeling the life energy of the world. And it's very hard to do alone. I think part of why sometimes we get apathetic is it's just too hard to do by ourselves. And, you know, if you're in a family or a social situation where nobody wants to talk about this and you're the only one who does, that's pretty hard. I wouldn't recommend that. So that's why we need each other and why we need to find each other and support each other. But this is pretty interesting. Joanna has a teaching that she offers in one of her books where she talks about the cost of blocking our letting ourselves feel the pain of the world. She says it. These are all her ideas. It impairs our cognitive functioning. It actually is cutting us off from data. It's cutting us off from data that we need. It limits our perception. We're less smart. We're less wise because we're cutting ourselves off from information. So it dulls our perception of the world. It cuts us off from information. It also cuts off our access to the unconscious. We put ourselves in a box, a safe box. I'm not going to feel it. I'm not going to feel it. And yet the wellspring of intuition and creativity comes from often what we don't know and maybe even what we find to be a little bit mysterious or scary. It actually cuts us off from the very necessary instinct for self-preservation. You know, like the self-preservation that if you touch the hot stove, you go, ow, that's good. It's good to feel that pain because then you're not going to burn your hand. But that's what we're doing. We're holding onto the stove and it's burning our hand, but we're not saying, ow, because we can't feel the pain. So do you see how this practice of opening to actually being able to feel it is kind of important for our intelligence and our ability to utilize our collective wisdom to help with this situation? It actually is what makes us human. I'll read this quote. She says, humans and some other big-brained mammals have a mind endowed with the self-reflective consciousness. Because the system's internal complexity is too great and its range of options are so large that it would no longer survive by trial and error alone. The usual trial and error that a simpler, and I don't mean this judgmentally, but a creature with a simpler mind can depend more on trial and error. But the more complexity your being embodies and needs to survive, trial and error alone isn't enough. We need this reflexive consciousness, this ability to think, this ability to reflect, to weigh different courses of actions, to be Manjushri. And in fact, she says in Buddhism, this is the definitive, you know, aspect of how we talk about the self, is ability to discover, you know, who we are by our choices. So very, very important to let ourselves feel. And there's Avalokiteshvara giving us a hand in doing that. Madeline Graham, the 16-year-old. Organizer of the Friday strikes, when the commentator asked her, how do you keep up your hope for the future? She said, first and foremost, the thing that drives my activism is I believe that we are going to win. I believe the youth will win. Because as Greta said in her speech, I do not believe that world leaders are evil. I refuse to believe they are evil. I think one day they are going to look at us children, my children, in the eye, and we are going to ask, is it worth it? Is your money and your greed and your power worth our childhoods and our lives? And I think they are going to say no. I think there is going to be a reckoning. People are going to rise up and the youth are going to win. Talk about hope in the face of despair. I believe it's possible that beings can awaken. I believe it's possible that there could be a reckoning. It could happen. It might not. Don't get me wrong, you know? And I'm sure they would all tell you the same. It could all go down really fast and be really bad. But even then, how do you want to go down? Don't you want to go down loving each other and taking care of each other as we go? So there's no harm in trying, whatever the ultimate outcome is going to be. But this is living by vow. This ability to say, I think one day they're going to have to look us children, my children, in the eye. And when we ask them this question, is it really worth it? I think they are going to say no. I think there's going to be a reckoning. This is aspiration. This is living by vow. I believe it's possible. And therefore, I'm going to put my action in service of living in the, as Charles Eisenstein said, the most beautiful world we know possible. He has a book called The More Beautiful World We Know Possible, right? Can we live our lives as if that could happen? And then if it was possible, how would we act? This is what I believe this is showing us, and this is living by vow. So then that brings us to action. Samantabhadra, shining practice bodhisattva, who rides an elephant. I don't know why, but she does. And a very interesting thing also about Samantabhadra, in addition to being the bodhisattva of action and practice, I have a book that has it's called the Radiant Sutras, and it has a lot of the Sanskrit terms. And Samanta, the root of Samantabhadra in Sanskrit, it's got a lot of different ways you can translate it, but the way that some of the ways this person translated Samantha is having the ends together, contiguous, adjacent, being on every side, whole, entire. So I thought, wow, that's a pretty cool additional element when we think about Samantabhadra. Samantabhadra, the one who is able to be on every side, the one who is whole. Remembering that we are part of this immensity, of this vast, terrible, terrifying and inspiring universe. So, of course, action, here they are, they're activists. So they're definitely engaged in action. And I know for me that can be really hard. I mean, probably why I talk about this is because I confess I get discouraged. I feel hopeless. I feel apathetic sometimes. It feels like too much, right? And so I think it's so important to always talk about, well, what inspires you to keep going? You know, what do you do when you want to just curl up in a ball and be apathetic? Sure, do that for a while. But after a while, don't you get kind of tired of it? I mean, how long can you do that? If you do it too long, it's depression. That's what depression is. I know, I had depression. That's what depression is. It's a cycling, it's a downward cycling story. That it's not worth it until you're not even getting out of bed. It's not worth it. So there's something about breaking that cycle that has to be about making some kind of connection with something that has meaning and value. And I would offer to you that connecting with each other is probably one of the most tried and true ways to reawaken our hope. And so when the activists were asked, how do you keep up your hope for the future? Carl, who's the 17-year-old Alaskan native fellow, very simply said, what gives me hope is the people that care. They want to help us out, and they want to do everything that they can to help us out. That's what keeps me going. And Elisa, a young woman from Oman, said, the fact that it's a question of survival of the people, I love. Okay, what gives you hope, Elisa? The fact that it's a question of survival of the people I love and my family gives me hope that I want to continue in this movement. It is elders and allies and young people, especially from indigenous communities, that have been fighting for decades. And this is so beautiful. And that all we have to gain because of the climate crisis. All we have to gain. What? It's giving us an unyielding deadline, but also a historic opportunity. As we're trying to get our emissions down and save the world we live in, we're being given a chance to push for policies that can dramatically improve our lives, that close the gap between rich and poor, that can create a large number of jobs and reinvigorate the way we live while bringing together, in an intersectional way, all our strong movements for justice, for indigenous rights, gender justice, jobs, for welfare. That's what gives me hope, is that there is so much for us to win. She's not whining in her oatmeal, you know? She's not whining. You know, here she is. She's the one who lives where there's not any water. You know, she's the one who lives where it's so hot that if we were there, we would probably be fainting, you know? And she's saying, wow, what an opportunity. We have so much to gain. It's a historic opportunity that as we learn how to do the things that we're going to need to do to bring the emissions down, we're going to be improving our lives in ways that matter to us. That's what gives me hope, is there's so much to win. So I hope that if anybody here can go away from tonight with some little spark of a feeling of encouragement, even though I've been describing really awful things, I invite you to consider this way of practicing and this way of being in the world where we face it, we face the facts, we feel the pain, we take care of ourselves and each other when we need to. If you're burned out, you don't go to the march, you know, or you don't go to the meeting. If you need to stay home and take care of yourself or take care of your loved ones, you do that. You don't sacrifice that. And at the same time, when you've got the energy, when you're ready, you do the work to inspire yourself, to motivate yourself, to connect with the people that will buoy you up and make it enjoyable and an exciting experience where you can feel some of the kind of passion that I heard and I felt as I listened to this wonderful interview and podcast sitting in my car driving down the road. So, it's a little past the time when we usually stop. So what I'm going to suggest for tonight is rather than engaging in questions now, that we can chant the Bodhisattva vows together and that we can go outside and have tea. And if you have questions or comments or if you'd like to talk with me more and engage more in this material, I'll be standing out there with my tea, and I'd love to have you join around if you're interested in that, and we can continue to work with this material a little bit if you like. So, oh, and me and my friend Glenn, who's sitting over there this Sunday, are going to spend a day in the San Lorenzo River Forest working with this very kind of material called eco-awakening. We're not going to be, like, telling you depressing facts and talking about bodhisattvas, but we are going to be doing direct engaging practices to awaken your own sense of connection with the natural world and your own way to be with the dilemma. So you could also ask about that. Ask him about it, because I'll be talking about this with people. So just. No, it's not. We just do this for fun, and I didn't make a flyer, so I'm just mentioning it in the context of this talk. So if you're interested, hopefully you can stick around a few minutes. You could ask Glenn. So may the merit of the courage and the wisdom of these young people inspire us and motivate us to all do whatever we can to help create the most beautiful world that we know is possible, and bring forth our understanding of the Buddha Dharma in service of that effort. Beings are numberless.
I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to rend them. Dharma. Surpassable.